So this morning, we're going to check in with a key staffer and attorney for the Marijuana Policy Project as Connecticut gets closer to legalizing adult recreational use, perhaps as soon as 2020. And speaking of 2020, it's time for the next segment of our series, Counting on 2020, Census Segments, as we head to the Naugatuck Valley to learn why the Valley Community Foundation and its supporters are so dedicated to educating and ensuring all residents understand the critical importance of being counted this year. And we'll close focusing on something old that has a brand new face and spirit. I'm talking about Advanced CT, formerly CIRC, and its dynamic new leader, who'll drop in to discuss how this newly branded non-governmental community and economic development organization is planning to jumpstart the state's economy. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vocat, right after this reminder. Patients fighting cancer need more blood than patients fighting any other disease, using nearly one quarter of the nation's blood supply. That's why this February, the American Red Cross and the American Cancer Society have teamed up to encourage people across the country to give blood, to give time, ensuring loved ones have the strength and support to battle cancer. Did you know that 5 units of blood are needed every minute to help someone going through cancer treatment? Yet only 3% of people in the United States give blood. More people are needed to donate regularly to help meet the need. These two organizations want you to know that when someone donates blood or platelets or makes a financial gift, they're helping to give patients and their families time, resources, and the hope they need to fight back. To schedule a blood or platelet donation appointment, make a financial gift, or to learn more, just go to giveblood2givetime.org. So my first guest this morning is representing the nation's largest marijuana policy organization. It's called the Marijuana Policy Project, and it was announced a couple of weeks ago that they hired Devon Ward to serve as senior legislative counsel, and in that capacity, he plans to play an integral role in legalizing marijuana in Connecticut, where he's a longtime resident. So my guest this morning has been a champion of civil rights throughout his career, and he's spent nearly the past decade gaining experience in law and public policy after coming out of UConn Law School in 2011. And he's in court right now, so you know, if you hear a gavel banging or somebody chatting in the background, it's that he's kind of found a corner there in the courtroom to talk with us for just a few minutes about some of the important points as Connecticut attempts once again to move towards legalization of recreational marijuana. So, Devon, great to meet you. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Hey, John. Thank you so much for having me on.
So the Marijuana Policy Project is a quarter century strong, founded in 1995, and its mission is really to change federal law to allow states to determine their own marijuana policies without federal interference. And I have to tell you, full disclosure, last weekend I led a panel of journalists up in Boston on teaching reporters and editors about how to effectively report on marijuana in terms of commerce, public health, business, public safety. And it was so interesting. But one of the mantras that kept getting repeated and repeated was this conflict between the federal law and the laws of the states that are working in whatever capacity to bring either medical and or recreational use to their citizens. So can we start off by you quickly just kind of explaining this interesting dichotomy between what's going on at the federal level and what's happening either here in Connecticut or generally at the state level?
Yeah, I mean, so the infrastructure, I guess, on federal law is that it's essentially being held together and cobbled together by a series of a rider that's attached to an appropriations bill that allows for states to be able to tax and kind of regulate this area. And also a Justice Department memo that essentially says that they're not going to prosecute states for engaging in this business, and that is essentially what's holding together the federal kind of infrastructure to allow states to be able to enter into this territory. And so that has been, you know, that activity has been going on, you know, for nearly a decade or so. Mm-hmm. And as you're starting to see more and more states kind of wade into that arena, but there's not really a really solid legal framework at the federal level holding this together. And it's kind of states kind of experimenting. And I know there is a bill that has been proposed in the House to officially take marijuana off the Controlled Substance Act. But as of now, that's still pending, and it's kind of being held together by this loose regulatory legislative framework at the federal level.
So as we speak today, essentially, it is a controlled drug federally. And the federal government can today use that status in whatever way its applicable leaders deem fit to do that. However, there has been a significant relaxing of the wherewithal to take that action against states or counties or municipalities at the local level.
Right. And so, you know, kind of the federal guidance is if the state passes a regulatory structure and they're licensing, they're you know, providing licenses, the state can't itself sell this product. But if they're licensing people to be able to cultivate and sell this product, the federal government is kind of taking a stance that they're not going to interfere in that as long as it's done in a licensed manner, and kind of an orderly manner. But there have been instances in the past where some states have not had a very tight regulatory framework, and the federal government has kind of interfered. You saw that in Montana, where they kind of had a loose regulatory framework, and they had a bunch of illegal shops kind of popping up, and the federal government stepped in at that point and did a couple raids. But for the most part, you know, states have been creating a strong regulatory framework and allowing licensure and inspections, et cetera. And the federal government has kind of, you know, taken a backseat and kind of let that activity go on. And so that is kind of where we are federally. But, you know, we are looking at states like California, Massachusetts that, you know, are in Colorado now, who have had, you know, longstanding medical and some now recreational legalization. And the federal government is kind of just taking a hands-off approach at this point, but it's really being held up by a really loose legislative framework on the federal level at this point.
Okay. Well, switching gears to the states then, first and foremost, what are a couple of the things that you have seen other states doing that Connecticut is either looking at to replicate or, you know, in some way borrow from to make a potential rollout of an eventual legalization for adult use situation here?
So I think Connecticut is looked at, certainly looked at Massachusetts. Illinois is another state, and then Colorado are some states that Connecticut is taking bits and pieces from. Things that we've seen and that we see in the governor's bill this year are, you know, the allow the ability for delivery services and just the taxation and revenue structure. I think is still kind of being hammered out. Because I think that's really dependent on each state. But in terms of the micro business piece, which was a big piece in Illinois, you know, the parts of the governor's bill has taken some cues from that in terms of looking at how kind of smaller operations can be set up and allowing for those micro businesses to be set up. And then also the equity piece in terms of, you know, where does the money go and how does the money get some of that revenue back to communities that have been impacted by the war on drugs. So, you know, that those are models that were taken, you know, from Illinois and pieces that were also taken from Colorado that you can see evident in the governor's proposal this year, too.
Yeah. To the extent you've looked at it, what has been the success rate in creating a system that does take these unique more inordinately prosecuted populations, neighborhoods, or communities into account for a bit of a head start, if you will, or creating some financial or other logistical advantages to establishing legal recreational adult marijuana use?
Right. So in Illinois, you know, the state actually put up a pot of money, put aside a pot of money for these startups to be able to apply for licenses and to be able to have less barriers for entry. Connecticut's model doesn't do that. Connecticut's model, actually, what they're proposing is it works off a point system, essentially, and then the points would be it's not even really spelled out in the bill, to be honest. It's supposed to be set up by the Equity Commission to kind of figure that out in terms of what incentives they're going to give to minority communities or communities that were, you know, disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. So it kind of takes a wait and see approach on that in Connecticut. But, you know, in other states, there have been instances where the state has actually, you know, set aside a pot of money, or a private organization has partnered with the state in a public and private partnership to be able to put up kind of that seed money or start money for folks from those communities that have been impacted. Mm-hmm. So we've seen that model in other states. I mean, and I think that's the benefit of you know, kind of the governor's approach in the sense is that I think Connecticut very much wants to, you know, draw off the lessons learned from other states over the years and be able to put together, you know, maybe a best practices kind of bill that draws from some of the examples in other states.
Great. Well, in the last few minutes that we have with you, Devon, can you just give us some of the critical high points of the governor's proposal that's going to be, vetted and perhaps even considered and passed in this short session?
Sure. So the governor's proposal would allow for legalized sales to begin in 2021. Excuse me, 2022. I'm sorry. And in the year leading up to that, it would create this equity commission that would look at the issue about how do you funnel the revenue, and how do you allow for folks who've been from these disproportionately impacted areas entry into this emerging industry. The bill does give local control over whether, you know, a local municipality wants to have this business in their district, but says that localities cannot prevent delivery services. So they can, a municipality could say, you know, we don't want a dispensary or a growery in our town, but they can't stop somebody from having a delivery service that operates in their town. The bill also talks about expungement of criminal records of folks who have marijuana convictions, nonviolent related marijuana convictions after 2015. And so that's one of the pieces where we're kind of hopefully gets worked out at, you know, in the committee stages, is trying to expunge, you know, all records of folks who have these marijuana convictions. We know there's some logistical challenges on the state's part in terms of accessing records from a far, far time ago. But that's one of the pieces we would like to see. But the governor's bill kind of draws that line at the year 2015. And so those are kind of some of the high level points. The governor proposes to tax plants by weight. And even that is a point. I think that's a negotiating point. The governor's bill is certainly a starting point. It's a work in progress, but those are some of the higher level 50,000 foot viewpoints of the bill.
Mm. In the last moment or two that we have with you, Devon, last year, if I remember correctly, this initiative actually got to the floor, right? Got out of committee.
It got out of committee. It never got called for a floor vote.
And it sounds like that might end up happening this year. It looks like crawling closer and closer to the eventual goal of this initiative. Is that the kind of feeling that you're getting in these early days of the session?
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're a person in my role, my job is sometimes to count votes. If you're looking at the makeup of the Senate right now, you know, we think that the votes are likely there. and the upper chamber. You know, there's certainly been signals from the Senate President Martin Looney that, you know, his caucus is at least ready to move forward. And if his caucus votes as a block, that certainly means that this can pass past the Senate. You know, the House is a little bit murkier,
sure.
And that obviously there's more members, and it's a more diverse party body. But we certainly think, you know, the votes in the Senate are strong, and with the governor lending his support and his platform, we think that this could be the year. We at the very least see an up or down vote, and hopefully we get it across the finish line.
Great. Devon Ward, a senior legislative counsel for the Marijuana Policy Project here in Connecticut, and a great community builder in the greater Hartford area, recognized as one of the new leaders of the law by the Connecticut Law Tribune back in 2019. As senior legislative counsel, Devon's going to play an integral role in legalizing marijuana in Connecticut, and he is prepared to work closely with state legislators, as we're hearing, and the Connecticut Coalition of Regulate Marijuana, as well as allies, to push for an end to prohibition in 2020. Lots more to talk about, but a great way to step off on this subject at this point in the session, Devon. Great to meet you, and hopefully we'll be talking with you again as this issue starts to develop and get some legs in the House. So thank you. All right. It's always wonderful when we find ourselves back in Derby at the Community Foundation. And this is an exciting time here. And this is also the third installment of our Counting on 2020 census segments, focusing on the upcoming census. We're here with Sharon Clausius and Alan Schwartz here at the Valley Community Foundation offices. And really happy to be kind of focusing in on both the opportunities and implications of the census to one of our local areas of community here in the Naugatuck Valley. So I guess the important question to start things off with for both of you is, from your perspective, talking from person to person that might be on the other end of the internet message or the phone call or the knock on the door, why is it important in general for folks to participate in the census, Sharon?
Well, John, thank you. And thank you for doing this series, because it is so critically important. I think it's underestimated that this is seriously just a count. How many people do we have in the country, the state, etc.? And that really determines how $675 billion is actually distributed from our federal tax dollars. We put that money in, and we want that money to come back to our state. And that's how it's allocated. And it really makes a big difference for our transportation, our education. You know, it really makes a big impact. House of Representatives, it tells us how many people we have in the House of Representatives.
Right. And Alan, I guess at some point, because of a census count, Connecticut actually lost a U.S. Congressperson at some point, right?
I understand in 2000, by the way, I'm delighted to be here. This is my second participation in the census. I did it in 2010, and here I am again in 2020.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm very committed to this work.
Yeah.
The representation is very important, okay, that we get these counts, because it does affect those things and those factors, okay? And in addition, by the way, this is going to be for 10 years. So whatever we count today, or in April, in reality, is going to be with us for the next 10 years. So if you have a child born in the next year and he's not counted, okay, if he wasn't counted, well, that's not going to be known going forward. So this is why it's very important that we get an accurate count at this time.
So let's talk and remind people how they're going to be notified about the census, because something that you didn't really have as much of or any of in 2010 was a lot of the e-capability, a lot of the internet potential.
Yeah, this is going to be different, and it's going to be easier, actually, for people. Actually, we're a month away from when the first postcards will go into the mail to tell people the census is coming. Mm-hmm. And they'll be told about the different ways they can respond. They can do it online. They can do it on their phone. They can fill out a form. So it's going to be made easy. And the expectation is that people will find this much more accommodating because they'll be able to actually do it in a much simplified form. And we'll continue to be reminding them over the next month that they have to do this, okay? And they will ultimately get a questionnaire as well. So as the months roll on, there'll be more and more information that says it's time to do it. In the event that they don't do it, then the census workers will have to come to the home to help them fill out the form. But the reality is, if they take the time to fill it out online or on their phone or with the questionnaire, it'll be done. And it's very important that it be done.
Excellent. Well, Sharon, you talked a little bit, kind of generally, as did Alan, about the implications of not completing the census. But if you could speak from your knowledge and your networking with so many nonprofits and community organizations here in the Valley, what are some examples or implications if a lot of folks don't respond to the census? Can you talk about an organization or an agency that depends on the kind of federal revenues that might supplement their operations and lack of it causing folks right on the front lines in the neighborhoods and communities to maybe not be able to get those services?
Oh, yes. I think my easiest example would be TEAM. Mm. TEAM is our community action agency here in our Valley region. They are paid from the federal government to take care of our Head Start, the needs of some of our most vulnerable people. Mm. And so let's say you have the census that says you've got, 140,000 people in your area. You've got how many thousands of kids in your area, but you ended up having a short count on all of that. Well, the federal government doesn't know that, but TEAM is going to feel that when they're trying to supply their to be able to give their support, their work, their resources to these individuals and families, and then to find out we have a lot more families than the federal government is saying that we have. Mm. And that's where the problem comes in. You think about it for so many of our different programs, English as a second language. We need to know how many people really need to be in these programs right. Without this count, the government is saying, okay, this is what you said. This is how many got counted. But what the reality is of our nonprofits face is very, very different.
Yeah, and I know we've talked about this before, but things that TEAM does, like their financial literacy initiative, yes. is actually helping people, helping to prevent people from having to go on to more additional public assistance because they have that financial literacy knowledge and support. They may be able to better sustain themselves in their own economic world. So this is critical, but also when it comes to sad irony and why it's so important that you guys are here with me is helping to remind everyone in your jurisdiction, everyone, because it's so often the people who go to these agencies for services who might be the ones who are most reticent or least mm-hmm. likely to participate in the census.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, we had another example at one of our meetings, one of our complete count committee meetings, in which somebody shared with us how they use a census for transportation needs.
Right.
And here, so many of us are talking about the Waterbury line, right? The train line. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. But if you don't have the numbers of people that are going to be using that line, or you're not going to have the census data of how many people are in this community versus that community, it makes a big difference in how the selections are made for all different types of projects because they use that data.
Now, Alan, when you were out with the 2010 census, were you being assigned to areas where you might assume it might be more challenging to get a good or complete count?
Well, it's very interesting because, first of all, if you remember, when the census was done in 2010, we were sort of coming out of the 2008 difficult period. Yeah. So a lot of people and a lot of jobs were available, which as they are today. Well, we actually hired people who lived in the community, okay? So they were comfortable going in to visit with these neighbors, okay, and help get the census data collected. And in the hard-to-count areas, we identified them, which are the hard-to-count areas, and we made sure that we had people go there specifically to meet these people to get the count. So a few homeless areas, we went into the homeless areas, and we got to the people, and we helped fill out the forms right there. So everything is done by the Census Bureau to make it an accommodating approach, community-based, okay, and that people feel comfortable when they come and knock on the doors, okay?
And I would imagine there were a number of incidents where you encountered people that initially put their hands up and said no thanks, and you were able to actually face-to-face communicate with them why they are the ones most important, because their count means sustained services for them.
That's a great question. And as the local census office manager, I would get a call from a resident who would say, stop coming to my house. I need to, don't bother me anymore. And I say, wait a minute, hold on a second. Let me tell you why this is important. And then as soon as you got a chance to chat with them a little bit, and I said, you know what, we'll do this right over the phone with you. So we would find ways to overcome any challenges that people might have, because it's important we get it done. There is no upside by not being counted. People have to think about it that way. If you're not counted, you're not counted for 10 years, okay? So there's no upside, and there's no downside. All we want to know is, how many people live in your area? And that's what this is all about.
I think that is one of the things we find so surprising. When you actually go online and you see the census, there are only 9 questions.
Right.
There are only 9 questions. You actually put more information down when you go for your driver's license than you do doing the census, because they're not asking for your Social Security. They're not asking you for your citizenship. They're not asking you any of those questions. It's what's your name? What's your birth date? How many people live in your house? What's your nationality or what's your ethnic background? That's it. Person number 2, who lives in your household, etc. I think if everybody knew how simple the census was, they wouldn't be so concerned about it.
We're going to take a quick break and be right back with the second half of our chat here at the Valley Community Foundation, talking about the census on this next segment of our series, Counting on 2020 Census Segments. Stay with us. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations that would love to have your support. You can learn about a number of them through LoveCT. And if you run, work for, or volunteer for a qualified nonprofit, apply now for a chance to receive a $5,000 radio contract to promote your brand, event, or nonprofit. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click onto LoveCT to apply for the grant and to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. This is John Voquette, your public affairs director here. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. You heard about it on our show. AARP is now accepting applications for the 2020 AARP Community Challenge Grant Program to fund quick action projects that spark change across the country. Grants can range from several hundred dollars for small short-term activities to several thousand or tens of thousands for larger projects. The AARP Community Challenge is open to qualified nonprofits and government entities, and AARP will prioritize those projects within permanent or temporary solutions that increase civic engagement, create vibrant public places, deliver a range of transportation and mobility options, support the availability of a range of housing, or demonstrate the tangible value of smart cities. The application deadline is Wednesday, April 1st, and all projects have to be completed this year by November 9th. If you're ready to submit an application or learn more, visit aarp.org/community-challenge. We're back. Thanks for sticking with us. This is the next in our For the People series, Counting on 2020 Census Segments. And
yeah, and never mind populations that are more challenging to capture. It's the ones who are probably more likely to want to participate because they understand the implications that are now getting a little scared because of things like census-related scams, which I know is something you also wanted to clue people in about.
Yes, I think anything that you're going to get from the Census Bureau is going to be by mail. Anything. You're not going to get phone calls. You're not going to get emails. You are only going to get it by mail and asking you to contact them, to either send in the form to them or to call them on the, to call the U.S. Census. Like, say some people that have, don't speak English very well, or they are fluent in Spanish or Portuguese or, you know, some other language. Yeah. They can call and make an appointment and have, and complete that census, as Alan was saying, you know, by the phone.
With facilitators.
With facilitators. Language, yeah. And so, but that is all by you saying, I want to do it this way. So people always have to be aware that they're just asking you to then respond to them. They won't come after you.
And so, there is nothing of an emergency nature that the census is going to do. So when people get these calls, and we get them every day, that sort of putting you on notice, there is none of that. This is simply, you need to complete the form. How do we help you make that happen? Okay, yeah. So if people are uncomfortable, they can say, hold on, I'm not going to talk right now. And they can call one of our local support centers, whether it be the library, and we'll help them through it. Yeah. So nobody has to react to anything they think is out of the ordinary, if you know what I'm saying.
Right, right. So you get a call or an email saying, we're a service that helps you process your census for a nominal fee. We'll fast track your information and make it easy on you. They're asking for money or donations to support the census effort, or they're asking you anything about your political persuasions or, God forbid, personal bank account or credit card information. This is something that people can easily ignore, hang up on, or delete, because everything of the legal official nature is going to roll off of U.S. Postal notification.
That was a great example that exactly. You just did. You bundled everything in there. Absolutely correct.
If you're I blame the other John for this for the great talking points.
No, you hit every nail on the head. I mean, that's absolutely correct. And if you're uncomfortable with what you hear, say sorry. Let me check. That's what I always used to tell my mother. If you don't know what to say, say, give me a number. My son will call you. Yeah. You know what I mean? Same thing here.
Good.
They just, okay. So yeah. You're right on the money.
So you worked on the census in 2010. Today, there are still robust opportunities, however temporary, for work on the census jobs. Just give us a quick one-minute spiel on what that entails, both in terms of applying and training.
Well, there's a website that they can apply. I'm going to say 2020census.gov/jobs, okay? They fill out an application. They try to place the local census workers in their area, okay? The pay is pretty good. I think it runs between $23 and $25 an hour, and it's scheduled around your schedule. So if you're a mom who's got a child in school and you can work during those hours, they'll try to fit you in those kind of arrangements. So it's very flexible, it's temporary, and you can do the application online. By the way, one other thing I'd like to point out. There is a ton of really good information on the census website. If anybody has any doubts, they can go and they can read about it. You know, you can just go to 2020census.gov and just poke one of those things, and you get a real comfort feeling on what is. And by the way, everything is secure and protected by law. So,
and I know the time is growing short, but people should also be reminded, if they're interested in a temporary census job, not every job involves canvassing door to door.
Correct. Not every job does it.
That's what you did.
That's right. In those days, we didn't have a lot of this automation that exists, so there was a lot of canvassing. It's going to be less canvassing, but there'll be office support jobs. There'll be other things, okay? So if you need it, apply. It doesn't hurt you to apply.
So, Sharon, I guess whether it's here in the Valley or wherever people may be listening, even you folks out on Long Island and down in Westchester County and such, I guess if everybody who hears this broadcast just tells one or two family members or neighbors and reminds them how important the census is, that kind of grassroots, face-to-face networking, if you will, to a trusted neighbor or family member is really critical. So really every citizen, no matter where they are, can play a role in helping promote the best outcomes of the census, right?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the key factors in this census this time is the grassroots efforts. People are encouraged to put together complete count committees that can be just their small little groups and little areas that they want to reach out to. But what we are told and what we know about human nature is that when you're hearing something from a friend or somebody you know, it makes a big difference and it makes a big impact on whether or not you're going to trust that source. So by talking to people about the census and being excited that the census is coming and to participate, people can start hearing whether or not somebody's like, I'm not doing that. You know, I don't want to put my name on anything. I don't trust this or I don't trust that or whatever it is. That's important to hear so that you know, maybe direct them to the census site, maybe send them some of the information that there is, like Alan was saying, there's so much information out there. But by having these conversations, you start learning about who and who is not planning on doing the census. And, you know, we really need to get this count. We really do. So, yeah. And like Alan said, you know, you're given probably, I think they said April and May and part of June to respond. And then they do start sending people to the door and knocking at the door, asking for that census to be completed. Mm-hmm. So we really ask people to, well before that, just, you know, complete the census.
Yeah, the implications of not doing it are grave.
There's no upside to not doing it. It doesn't help anybody if you don't do it.
And it could be a grave implications in the worst case.
Yeah, I mean, some states will lose representation this year. Some states will lose money this year because of the count is shifted. People have been moving. So you want to make sure that in your state that we count everybody so that we get the maximum benefits we can get. You know, in this 2020 census, which is not going to be repeated till another 10 years.
Right. And for folks who joined us late, they should be reminded that at one point, because of Connecticut's lack of participation in the census, we lost a U.S. state representative as a result of it. Never mind the millions, perhaps in the aggregate billions of dollars that typically flow into human services, social services, community service organizations that really need it most because they serve the people who are most marginalized and in need. Quickly, Alan, also the other people that can get involved are the business owners. There's an opportunity for some potential in-kind items to provide or services?
I have to tell you that the businesses can be very helpful. We had a conversation before we started this about all these screens that exist in offices now. Mm. Nothing could be easier than putting up a census ad in any of these offices when people are sitting there in doctor's offices and get a comfortable feeling about, hey, what is this, the census, and hear it right there in the quiet of this little environment. So I think there are opportunities for business to help us get the word out. By the way, think about this. Businesses want this data as well. They want to know where the population is moving so they can make decisions on where they put medical offices, where they put shopping centers, where they put this, transportation. So this data serves the community in many, many ways. Yeah. Okay.
The economic development dollars that could flow into your community because your census count was correct could be lowering your tax dollars.
Absolutely.
I think, how aren't politicians cluing in on that?
Yeah, I know.
But somebody could become the mayor of Derby with that platform, couldn't they?
Absolutely correct.
But one of the things that you were saying that we do have to be aware of is that people do need to go to the census website, pull down that material. Everything is digital. They can go there and get those videos that Alan was talking about, get flyers, get postcards. Everybody can do their part in helping this census really be successful.
Great. And I was going to ask Alan for that website in a moment. Because we're running out of time, I just want to remind folks in the Valley area that this is so important. The Valley Community Foundation is dedicating an entire edition of their newsletter to the Census 2020 that'll be available in March. So this is a really, really important thing. If businesses join in by putting up some sort of a message or sending some sort of an email to their employees to remind themselves and their friends to do it, or putting it up on their waiting room screens or in any other way, supporting the census, it's mission critical. So it all starts at a nice, easy website. Alan, let's hit you.
Well, here's the one for jobs right there, 2020census.gov/jobs. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And if you just did 2020census.gov, you're going to be opened up to a whole
all the materials.
All kinds of material, particularly public service announcements that are already done, can be easily taken and loaded on your system. So there's no shortage. And by the way, the businesses don't have to invest in anything. It's all done. Just use it and get it out there for us.
You don't need anybody's permission to do it. You just do it.
And our recommendation is people don't have to invent things. It's there. So just use the census material. It's wonderful. It's clear. It's fun. And it gets the word out, which is what we're suggesting.
The benefits of participating in the census end up benefiting the ones who participate the most. So please spread the word, 2020census.gov for general information. If you're looking for a job, 2020census.gov/jobs. Hear from the Valley Community Foundation with their director, Sharon Closius, and Alan Schwartz, former 2010 census worker and now heavily involved here, both supporting the foundation and the Valley census efforts. This and the next of our series, Counting on 2020 Census Segments, coming to you from here in Derby, Connecticut. Thank you guys for being part of the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, long-time regular listeners to the program know that one of our kind of perennial guest segments have been talking with folks from an organization called CERC. Well, CERC has formally rebranded itself to Advance CT. It used to be the Connecticut Economic Resource Center. It's a nonprofit. Advance CT, I should say, now is a nonprofit organization that works to engage, retain, and recruit businesses and advance overall economic competitiveness here in Connecticut. And we are pleased to be talking with their brand new leader, Peter Dinius. He leads the Advance CT team as its president and CEO. He joined on in August 2019. As an accomplished private equity and venture capital professional, help realize commercial and economic opportunity by connecting ideas, people, and capital. He used to work for FLAG, Flag Capital Management, and its successor, Aberdeen Standard Investments, based in Stamford. And we're so pleased to have him on the phone to talk about how this agency is going to take Connecticut to the next level in terms of the work that was formerly being done by CERC and is now going to get kind of supersized and supercharged under the Advance CT banner. So, Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me on.
So aside from the kind of historical introduction, talk to us a little bit about what the structure of Advance CT is and how much of that structure has been retained from CERC and how much of it is really kind of new or a morphing of what used to be.
So happy to cover a little bit about our governance and just our funding model. So we continue to be funded by the state and by the private sector. And that's always been the case for CERC's, for the vast majority of CERC's 26 or 7 year history. We are specifically funded by DECD, the Department of Economic and Community Development, and the utilities. They, for a long time, have supported CERC, and they continue to support CERC. And in fact, DECD has increased its financial support. We also have been cultivating a board of directors and members that have agreed to fund CERC as just private as the private sector, if you will. Mm-hmm. I can talk more about that.
Well, I'm interested. I was going to stop you there because you've already piqued my curiosity. You know, it's a new agency, kind of a new bright shiny object. Not to minimize it, but that is never a reason for DECD to channel additional revenues at a project. It's not just all the new stationery and branding. What are some of the aspirations that DECD is hoping to experience by enhancing the revenue to your agency?
Yeah, I think the this really goes back to Governor Lamont's vision for Advance CT and seeing an opportunity to become much more aggressive and much more proactive when it comes to business retention and recruiting and leverage the private sector in this endeavor. And we have a lot of folks that have an interest in seeing Connecticut improve, and we have a lot of companies here that would love to see Connecticut head in a better direction. And I think the governor rightly tapped that energy and initiated a process whereby we reconstructed our board and invited some new people to the table to, again, tap that energy. And as part of that, that vision for advanced CT and again, tapping that private sector expertise and that energy, DCD, I think, agreed to increase its financial commitment along with the private sector. And so we are trying to much more aggressively pursue that mission and that vision, which CIRC had done episodically in the past, but this is obviously now with just more resources, more firepower, and again, drawing on a lot of expertise and interest across the state.
Hmm. So at this point, I know we're early in the game here, but is your eventual goal to see advanced CT become more self-sustaining and less dependent on taxpayer dollars and more dependent on private sector? Do you want to walk the line at around 50-50 in terms of revenue and logistical support? How do you see the breakdown between taxpayer funding and private sector support?
I think it'll be at least 50-50, if not tilted more in favor of the private sector over time. But I think, you know, for us to be successful, whether it's with taxpayer money or with private sector money, we have to be successful. We have to deliver on our repurposed mission, and that's to grow the economy, that's to add jobs, that's to bring that's to keep companies first and foremost here in Connecticut, and to bring new companies, to the state. So, if we're going to achieve that, then I think again we have to deliver results. And as a private not-for-profit, we again are not a state agency. Not that we have anything against state agencies, but we are holding ourselves accountable to very high standards of performance. And I think again for us to achieve our mission and our goals, whether it's funding or otherwise, we've got to deliver results.
So your focus is business engagement, retention, and recruitment. At this point, we are so past the recession era, and yet, you know, Connecticut is still looked upon from a lot of points on the inside and a lot of points on the outside as being still lagging behind. It just, you know, it can't seem to catch up even to our neighboring states that are apparently enjoying a measurably higher level of engagement on the same fronts that you're hoping advanced CT will. Tell us a little bit about how you're going to hit the ground running and trying to really at least, you know, get us up to speed where the rest of the country, or at least the rest of our New England or neighboring states are in terms of business engagement, retention, and recruitment.
Yeah. So it's not all bad news. I think we as a state need to keep that in mind. You know, our economy is growing. It grew at 2.1% in the third quarter of 2019, and that's kind of middle of the pack relative to other states. We are adding jobs. We had 6,000 jobs last year. We're growing that at about 0.3%. Now, that's, you know, obviously we're on the positive side of the ledger there, but look, the best states in the nation are growing jobs more like, you know, 1 to 1.5% per year. So admittedly, we've got more work to do, more improvement. But again, I just think, just to put things in context, it's, you know, the wheels are not coming off the bus here.
No.
And we want to do better on a number of these metrics. But we I think feel that it's within our grasp. We need to do a better job executing, particularly on business development and whether that's retention or recruiting, and can, you know, get on our front foot a little bit. We, as a state, as you know, we're on top for a long, long time. We had 35 Fortune 5 companies here in Connecticut. We're at 16 today. you know, so still strong, albeit it's not 35, but we still have a lot of great companies and a lot of great assets here that we need to get out and proactively sell. That's what really brought me to the role, is we have this opportunity to just, you know, be much more aggressive. And as you may know, many other states come calling on Connecticut companies to relocate, and we have the opportunity to be doing the same.
Yeah. Well, in the last couple of minutes we have with you, Peter, one of your missions is going to be to advocate for favorable business conditions that improve Connecticut's competitiveness. And certainly I hear on the record from a lot of people, including lawmakers and folks in economic development, and off the record much more loudly, that there are a number of key elements in the state from a regulatory standpoint, et cetera, that are holding us back. Do you agree with that? Or even if you don't want to talk about it that way, can you talk a little bit about how you're going to play a role and your agency is going to play a role in helping to kind of overcome that either real or apparent stigma?
Yeah, just a couple of things. Again, just to reiterate, we are not an agency. We're not a state agency. We're a private not-for-profit, jointly funded, you know, in this public-private partnership format, as we talked about. The second point is, it's actually not our mission to advocate for regulatory change. We leave that to others who do it quite well. I would call them partners in sort of the bigger picture of economic development here in the state. That's CBIA specifically, that is really advocating and lobbying for policy changes that could help us as a state. So that's not our role. Having said that, I think there are things just at a high level that, sure, they warrant consideration. They warrant a close examination to see if we can do better. You know, we do not get rated well as a state for being, you know, business friendly. And I do believe that there are things that we can do to improve that. And we're taking a close look at what are those things. And they may or not be, you know, regulatory driven. They may not be, you know, statutes or what have you. There could be other things that we could be doing better. And so we're taking a close look at that and seeing what role we can play in there. But I want to be clear, we're not advocating or lobbying for those types of changes. We're much more focused on, frankly, developing a better Connecticut brand. And I think we can all agree we need to do a better job first marketing to ourselves and identifying our strengths and articulating those to ourselves, and then do that much more aggressively outside the state, as we've been talking about.
Great, yeah, and I want to apologize to you and to our listeners. I know we wanted to kind of retool that that point there to get to the answer that you provided, and I'm sorry about that. However, our time is short, but I really hope that our award-winning For the People and Advanced CT can create a relationship so that we bring you into the program on a fairly regular basis or a designee of yours through Advanced CT to talk about the work you're doing. It's pretty exciting when you have kind of the foundation of CERC, but this whole new energy and this whole new attitude and this dynamic leadership that you're bringing to the picture. So I'm really looking forward to chatting with you and your people again on a regular basis as Advanced CT begins to do what it is apparently poised to do. And we're all pretty excited about that. Peter Dinius is with Advanced CT. He's their new leader, and Advanced CT is endeavoring to be a leading to make Connecticut a leading state in the nation for economic growth and job opportunities for us all by 2025. So great to meet you in this initial chat, Peter, and we'll be talking to you again soon. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
What defines Ohio? A place that dares to go first and never looks back. There's no slowing us down. In Ohio, we're powering America, discovering breakthroughs, driving the future, propelling tomorrow. At Jobs Ohio, our mission is clear: strengthen job opportunities and empower Ohio's workforce. Ohio, our time is now. See Ohio's momentum at jobsohio.com/Ohio's time.
Are you a questioner, a wanderer, or even a bit of a snooper? If so, then you'll feel right at home in Knoxville. We've got miles of trails to wander in our urban wilderness, award-winning eateries to satisfy your culinary cravings, cultural sites to open your mind, and dog-friendly activities that'll have everyone wagging. Knoxville, calling the curious. Learn more at visitknoxville.com.